Welcome. You're listening to a Teachers Network podcast, a series that features some of the best minds in public schools today.
Carmen Farina got an Impact 2 grant in 1981 and has been part of our network ever since.
I'm actually much younger than that. Go ahead.
One of my favorite moments ever was a breakfast at NYU where Carmen got up and said, I was a teacher for 22 years and never regretted one day. So Carmen has more authority, experience, expertise than almost everyone I know in education. She was a teacher for 22 years. She was a principal. She was a superintendent. She was a regional superintendent. She was a deputy chancellor up until recently. And she's a member of our board of directors now. So we are so fortunate to have someone who started out in our network a whole bunch of years ago as a grantee who's now on our board. And you are going to learn a lot. Because every time I talk to Carmen, I learn a lot. So, Carmen.
Thank you. Please. When Ellen asked me to speak today, I said, how honest should I be? And then I realized, and she lashes, well, even if I told you not to be, would you be anywhere else? So I think it's important that you understand the context of what I'm saying today is really about the things that I am particularly concerned about and that I think all of us should be concerned about. And the fact that you're an international group, I think, is even more relevant because I think that for the first time probably in as I can remember, the concerns are the same no matter where you come from. Whether it's not a New York City issue, not a Chicago issue, not a Denver issue, it's only not UK or Ireland. I spend a lot of time in Spain, which is my Spanish being my first language, and all my relatives are in education. And basically they blame everything that's gone on there on the American system. You know, we imported writing process. You know, we got rid of high level. And we're going to mandatory promotion. They just decided to do the opposite and only need to pass 2 tests out of 5 tests. So, because they want to get the kids out of school sooner because they don't know what to do with 16-year-olds in sixth grade. And I know it's one of the issues that also is true of UK and Ireland and Scotland and all the ministers. I met with the ministers of Japan, China, when I was deputy chancellor, and every one of them came with the same issues. And the issues being our kids are not graduating. They're not graduating with enough skills to be productive members of society. And those that are graduating are not going into the workforce so that we can start being competitive worldwide. And any of you who haven't read Friedman's book on The World is Flat, that certainly has international implications. So what happens is often happens in education, we look for a quick fix. And the quick fix, I think, has been, well, let's all become businesses, or let's look at business and see what we can learn from business to improve education, without, I think, asking the essential question, where is the real intersection, and how has business really been successful? Business should not be a generic term. It should be which businesses are successful and why. And certainly in New York City, one of the people who spoke to us a lot in the new reform was Jack Welch. And what Jack Welch kept saying over and over again is that it's important for businesses to focus on people. And sometimes I think that's not what's done. So I'm hoping to not talk the whole time. I really would like some Q&A from the audience for whatever services that I can offer. But the reality is that public education, and I consider it a personal thing for me because I have 2 grandchildren who I would like to see take part in public education because I think it is the best place for a democracy. I think we also have to assume that we still honor democratic values, and I'm not always sure that that's the case. Is it that we want kids to be in our schools to become thinking people, or is it that we want them to become rote memorizers and then just be able to regurgitate what either government or someone else wants from them? And that's my puzzle, and where I'm in a quandary because I'm seeing too much of standardized tests moving people towards, if you can take a test, you can fill in the blanks, but what happens when you have to get up and defend your rights? Or what happens when you have to get up and say, this is what I believe in and why? So, you know, with all the money that's going into a national curriculum, an international curriculum, not having thinking on the table and developing skills in kids that can speak in front of an audience and develop their own opinions really worries me. But having said that, I said business does have a vested interest in public education, first and foremost, because they need a workforce that is going to have a viable economy. And the second thing is we need citizens who know how to make decisions, and I don't think those are always working together. I think sometimes those things are opposites. But let me tell you why I think we came to the conclusion that business was our savior. And I, you know, think that we have a lot to learn from business, but I also think there's a lot business can learn from education, and I don't see it being a two-way street. And certainly I would like to see partnerships, but not where the CEO model becomes the principal model. To me, a principal or a superintendent should be the master teacher. And there's a real difference between a master teacher and a CEO. A CEO can function by having the skills to hire the right people. All of you who are in education know that if the master teacher doesn't show that they know what's going on in the classroom, the credibility that you have for other people to follow you is really diminished. And those, I think, are one of the major differences. But let's think about how we got to this point today. And let me tell you what I think does work between business and education and where it intersects. First and foremost, they both have a client. And they have a client that they really have to know well. And I think for too long in many educational systems and in specific schools, we assumed that if we had 600 kids, all 600 kids were the same, that they all needed the same approaches, they all needed the same type of teachers, they all needed the same curriculum. And the reality is that if you are going to look at your client body, that you should be doing a lot more analyzing of data and using that data to better your product. And businesses have done this by and large because otherwise they don't have a profit margin. So if you're going to analyze your data, and let's say you're a car company, and look at what's happened to GM versus Toyota already, you're going to make sure that you do surveys, satisfaction surveys out there, and find out, you know, would you buy another car from us? If so, yes. Why not? So analyzing the data is something that I don't think educators did enough of, and I don't think they did enough of it in a real thorough way. And one of the things, because I am working with middle schools this year, I'm working with 35 middle schools, one of the things that I've asked them to analyze their data very, very deeply. And this is one of the things I actually shared with the people who came from Europe to talk to us. This is not about absolute scores. How many kids do you have level one, level two? How many kids do you have pass form A or form B? It's about disaggregating data to the point of a business that they would do it. Why is the people in Brooklyn buying more of these kind of cars versus people in Manhattan? A business person has to know that because they have to know how to vary their teaching, their selling strategies to them. In education, one of the things that I got very involved in is looking at gender differences. Can I analyze the data by male and female? And we found some unbelievable things that once we analyze the data, not only male and female, but also multiculturally in terms of ethnicity, we decided that maybe one of the things we should be doing in New York City that would make sense is to have single-sex classrooms in seventh grade, which we found had the biggest gaps between male and females, and having them in math and science. So a lot of the schools that I'm working with this year actually now have single-sex classes in math and science. And we picked seventh grade because it was the one place we thought made the difference. So looking at data that completely is very, very important. And I think it's something we did learn from business. We learned that when business looked at data, they looked at their sales projections. They looked at where people were going. The same thing looking at data, I think, also when it comes to teachers. If there are teachers who seem to be getting better performance, and I'm not talking about absolute test scores on one test, but I'm saying if you look at a sub-skill on a test and you see, and I used to do this as a principal all the time, that teacher A is much better at teaching computation skills and teacher B is much better at teaching problem solving, why aren't they working together in each teaching that sub-skill to each other's classes in ways that make sense? So looking at data to make the product better, and in this case, it's teaching. And we started looking at that kind of data. We also started looking at data that says, is there one grade, and I know this can be somewhat controversial, but is there one grade where it actually is more important to put more of your money? Because on the other thing that we have in education is that we have to play fair with everyone. And the reality is that equity and fairness are not always the same thing. So there are some classrooms or some people who might need to be in smaller class size. If I had to apportion money differently, I would have smaller class size, which I was able to do when I was superintendent, in my middle schools and have larger class sizes in elementary schools with some support in those classrooms. Because it makes more sense in terms of the product you're delivering. but you have to look at the data to make those decisions. So I think now we're data-driven. I think some of it is very good. I think what's very bad is that we're staying focused too much on an absolute score. A car company is not going to just look on how many Camrys they sold. They're going to look at where they sold them, what color sold the most. Is there a color that didn't sell at all? They're going to look at the disaggregation of the data and then change what they're doing based on that disaggregation. And I think if we're going to go into a system that's going to go, how many level ones do you have in your school, I think that's really a problem. So I think looking at data is important. I think also if you're in a company, you define and redefine everything you do in that company based on the data. And I think what doesn't happen or happens in business is that if you've seen, let's say, again, we're going to keep using the analogy of the cars, that Toyota finds out that they didn't sell any of their green cars. So next year they decide they're not going to sell the green cars anymore. Makes sense, right? That's what the data shows. You're not going to put out something out there no one's going to buy, so you stop doing it. Well, think if educators took the same stance. You decide that your special ed kids are not progressing well. So then you decide you're not going to teach them anymore. Or better yet, you as a school are going to decide you're not going to accept them. By the way, this is happening all over this country, okay? Mm-hmm. We're creaming off the top, creating more and more schools for special kids, and by special mean the kids at the top. And who's going to take on the responsibility for the kids who may not give you the scores you want? But if you're talking about a democracy, if you're talking about the belief that education can change people's lives, what are our responsibilities? Because we're not a business, we're a people person kind of business, that says that the kids who need us the most will have the best teachers, the best situations, and the most support. And this is a real fear that I have, and I think the one thing NCLB has done well is that all kids have the high expectations. In New York City, we found last year that the highest percentage of scores that helped bump up in many schools was all of a sudden how fast some of our special education, special needs kids went up, simply because for a change, we were saying to teachers, you can't get away with babysitting, you actually have to teach them. I know this is a European problem as well. I'm hearing it for the first time. You are looking at inclusion classes, you're looking at strategies. We now know that there are specific strategies. I mean, Wilson, Great Leaps, Read 180, I can run you a whole list of them. But we can't talk about how much they cost, because that can't be what stops them from being used. We need to say, this group needs this, and that's not something business would do. Business is not going to say, okay, the color green did not sell, therefore, we're going to keep it in the inventory, and we're going to figure out we can redefine it a little bit better. You know, we'll add a stripe to it, whatever. This is not where the correlation fits. So a lot of things fit. That doesn't fit. I think also that how you report results is a lesson that we should not be learning from business. Okay, when you get test results, they go in the head, well, in New York City anyway, they hit the papers, okay? And you have these ratings, and then they're seen as absolute, and everybody goes around, oh my God, this school scored here, and you know, how do we get to our kid in that school? And it doesn't go beyond the fact that, what's the teacher turnover? Are people satisfied working in that building? Do parents seek to come in that building because there's a lot of parent involvement, or parents are welcomed, or there are after-school programs if there are a lot of parents in that community who need that kind of service? If you're looking at business, you can read your results any way you want. And if you're a public company, what have you done in terms of your stockholders? You've given them certain information, but if you're smart, you can skew information to say anything you want. And unless you have stockholders who are very savvy or have a political agenda of their own and can go to a meeting and then get rid of their CEO, they still have to do something that education doesn't have the luxury of doing. Because you can sell your stock, you can, you know, opt out, you can decide you're not going to invest in the stock market or in that particular company. In the way schools are set up today, and I think this is true almost everywhere, you have your local schools. I mean, certainly in Europe, as you go up, you choose according to how well your grades get where you go. But the reality is that schools do not have the option of necessarily getting rid of a leader, but also the leader doesn't always have the ability to do the transparency reporting out that they should. And less is there the voice of the stockholders. I mean, one of the trends we're seeing nationally is that decisions are being made that sometimes eliminate people like teachers and parents and ultimately the kids. So I think that's a lesson that we have to, and also, which are the companies that are doing such, how are we rating those companies? Is it because the profits they make? Is it how much the CEO gets paid? I mean, think about the lessons that we're saying, this is the model we want to follow. Why should a CEO be getting paid the millions of dollars that's not dispersed down to the people in the field? Well, the same thing should be true if a school is successful. How is that success being measured, and what's the merit that goes back into that school? Do you reinvest your profits? How does that go? For a long time in New York, and I assume this is true at least in our country, from what I know in some of the international countries, that the more successful you were as a school, the less money you got, because most of the money went for compliance and compensatory education. So if you did well, you did not get a profit. And then what happened is the better you did, remember, you got a lot, I mean, I'm just thinking of myself as a principal. When I started my principalship, I had a lot of kids who needed support, and although it was in a very viable neighborhood. And I had a $300,000 budget for supplementary support. As my scores got better and everything did well, I actually lost that whole $300,000 over a two-year period. Because the idea was that if you were doing well, you didn't need the money for extra help. And yet, if you're going to look at a democracy, well, kids who are doing very well should also have the opportunity to have enrichment and so forth. In business, you would honor that. So how do you make sure that you get that balance in education? I think one of the biggest issues that we have right now, and I think I can argue this one on both sides actually, is that education has become a competition. And for too long, there was only one game in town. You went to your local public school. Certainly, I know in Europe, there were designated parameters of where you went. Certainly in elementary school, it was different. And then parents made other decisions. They could choose to go to private education, which would be independent schools. They might choose parochial education. Now you have the charter school movement, and you now have businesses starting partnerships, which are creating whole other schools. However, I think if you were buying a car, you would go to the dealer, and you would have tickers, you know, tickets on the cars, and you could look at the comparisons between here, here, and here. I don't think you have transparency in the competitive field of education. And that's a real worry. So, for example, when the scores get posted in the New York Times, the scores are not posted for anything other than public education. I remember one year in New York City, the Daily News decided to publish the scores of all the parochial schools in New York City in comparison with the neighborhoods of the public school square. It caused an unbelievable commotion. Then they decided to do it with the independent schools. And what they showed, that if the neighborhood was constant, that the schools were in, public education actually outperformed both independent schools and parochial schools. In my school, which was on the Upper East Side of New York, for those of you who know the geography of New York, we actually outperformed three of the most expensive independent schools in New York City. We also outperformed all the suburban areas like Ardsley and Dobbs Ferry, and we had all these people coming down to see what it was that we were doing that was moving us in this direction. And that transparency lasted 1 year. Because of political pressure, you will never see those scores in public again. So how are we, when we're comparing apples and oranges in many cases, and I think that's really another issue that we need to kind of take on as educators, nationally and internationally. I know also when you look at the scores, and again, I'm going back to, and certainly in Europe, a lot of it would be independent or parochial schools, where is there, just by the fact that they have admissions procedures to get in, and also expelling procedures. We know that many of our charter schools, although there's a lottery system, are expelling kids, although it's against the charter movement. And then that means who goes into these schools and what happens to the kids. And they don't take on special ed kids or ELL kids as a policy. So how do we make sure that that moves in another direction? I think the issue here is who monitors and who's monitoring the companies. I mean, any big company in the United States is monitored either very little or simply by the market, you know, the free enterprise market. We now have in education so many monitors that it almost, you know, I sometimes wonder who is not watching us, okay? So you have the federal government, then you have the state government, then you have the city government, then if you have mayoral control, you have another layer of that. And then often you then have businesses who want a piece of the action because obviously education is profitable, and then that can add another layer in terms of who's watching, who's selling, who's, you know, who's buying and all that stuff. And then they say, but you know what, you can really do good as an educator if you can do whatever you want in your school. Well, by the time all these layers go down, I would say the rate of autonomy in a school goes from 100% probably to maybe 40 to 50%. Certainly when I was a principal, I would say the autonomy that I had was great as long as I was performing well. And that's the way it should be. Once my kids start to fail, I shouldn't be allowed to be in business. But think about all the businesses out there who are failing. And think about all the businesses who choose not to get involved. All of us have to educate all the kids. And yet, you have a lot of problems out there that companies are choosing not to build a product for. I mean, just looking at, you know, AIDS and some of the things that we know we need a solution for, but it's not profitable for them, or it's not in their best interest. So we have that dichotomy, I think, between business and education, and the monitoring that I think is really, really important. To me, the single biggest issue where there's a big difference between education and business, and you might disagree with me, is the notion of integrity and community building. Educators, by the very nature of their job, whether you're a teacher or an administrator, you come to the business of education assuming that you have to build a collaborative community, that people have to feel that your vision is the right vision and that you're going to follow that leader no matter where they take you, because you're in the business of making sure that because of you, someone else is in a better place, meaning the kids. And I think that for those of us who believe that leaders can only be true leaders if people follow them, and also good leaders also develop succession plans for themselves, that a good superintendent, a good principal, certainly at the national government level, is what are you doing to ensure that this whole sense of integrity, that people don't lie, that people not only tell the truth, but model in their own lives what they want the people who work for them to do. And if you think in businesses, certainly, and here I'm going to stick to our own country, although there are many examples internationally, think about what we just read in the papers day after day. You know, the CEOs who have unbelievable salaries that, you know, justify based on what? CEOs who have managed to, you know, defraud the stockholders. I mean, think about all the issues of integrity. And why do we see this as a model that we have to emulate when in reality, we're our model has to be for the kids who observe us at work. If we have leaders who are not full of integrity, who don't tell the truth, who are not transparent in their work, how do we expect everyone to be able to do what they have to do? So I think that's a lesson that I would like to see more COs learning from us rather than us learning from them. And obviously in both cases, there's good and bad on both ends, but it's learning from the best in both places. When we met with Jack Welch a lot in the first level of reforms, one of the things he said that leaders should be judged by how many other leaders they create. And you cannot create good leaders unless you think aloud a lot and unless you know that everything you do, you're working towards making sure that you put yourself out of business. And a good leadership program and certainly good schools create teachers to become leaders. That's what I think Teachers Network is all about. One of the things that I will always be grateful as a classroom teacher for 20 years when my principal said to me, you're doing some unbelievable stuff in your school. You should apply for, at that time, was an impact grant, because you should be able to go before other audiences and become a leader in your own right. And that was the way she pushed me sort of half out the door, but I think it was also a way of saying you have more to offer. And I think we do that in education. Good businesses also do it, but we don't do it enough in education. So I think that's, you know, another piece. I think the issue of who you hire, and this is obviously very controversial, but in most businesses, if your employees are not up to snuff, you have, it's a free market. You can get rid of them. You can find them other jobs. You can advise them to leave. I mean, you may have a little, you may have to give them severance pay, but you have the ability within the structure to do that. And I do think we're moving in that direction nationally. I think obviously there's a tension there about that. But the reality that we have that ability is something that we should also have in education. And the education market should be based on the fact that, you know, are you producing the kind of work that we think is high quality work in this particular situation? We also have in many places, and again, I know this is part of what's going on in Europe, you almost have a surplus. I mean, in the United States, we need more teachers. The workforce in New York is now coming from all over the world. I mean, our math curriculum is being taught mostly by international teachers. But the agreements we've made with these countries, interestingly enough, has been to employ their teachers for 2 years until there is an opening back in their countries. This is not about we're giving you our teachers forever. We need these people to stay in teaching because we know teaching is important. So you hire them because you need them. But once they also learn American customs, speak English better, they are of a better service to us. And this is something that I think is relatively new and probably has not been taken advantage of as much as it could be. Because if you're thinking about a global market, what's the best way to increase that globalization other than having sort of like a teacher exchange? But this two-year also means that more and more teachers need to be aware of what the customs and the multiculturalism of each other's countries. I think one of the biggest surprises that I've had, and here again goes to teaching, if you're a CO and you're running, again, let's go back to a Toyota factory, anywhere in the world, that assembly line is going to be the same, no matter where that factory is. And yet if you're doing teacher preparation, you're doing it so differently that when we start all these teacher exchanges, it's almost a culture shock. In my work with international teachers, the biggest surprise I got is how they were still coming into the classroom thinking that the mere fact that they stood in front of the classroom meant that the children were going to listen to them. And they would say this to me. Where's the respect? I walk in. No one's listening. And my answer is, well, what have you done to deserve it? Well, in my country, they just listen. Well, I happen to know from my cousins in Spain that doesn't happen like that. There's more depression and leave of absences for teachers in Spain right now than any other career in terms of the government paying for people to take leave of absence for depression. Because they still come into classrooms thinking people are going to listen to them rather than they're doing changing their teaching styles to be modified to what the kids need today. Now, any business would change their style if they saw it wasn't going to have a profit. We're still in a factory model at a time when the factory model doesn't work anymore. So when we now try to convince teachers that you need to have interactive learning, certainly in middle schools, that's my big challenge. I'm still doing model lessons in front of classrooms to convince teachers that the kids are not going to fall apart if I actually let them talk to each other. And then they'll say, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe that. But it works. So what are we doing to upgrade our skills to keep up? I mean, one of the things also that I've heard this morning, and I know from Ellen, the two Ellens, is that the one thing the Teachers Network has done that I think was revolutionary back then, and unfortunately is revolutionary 10 years later, which is a shame, is that they have used technology probably smarter than any other organization I know. And why aren't we doing more technology in our schools? Because it's expensive. I know, again, and I go back to the country in Europe, but I'm sure it's true in Spain, that they finally had to put in, it was the most, of the European Union, the common market countries, it was one of the most backward, I mean, I hate to use that word, but you'll understand what I mean by that, in terms of the use of technology. So what did they decide to solve that problem? They built computer schools within every so many, what would be a borough here in New York, to ensure that at least the kids would have elementary technology skills. But I think that very, very few kids were graduating college in Spain, and I'm assuming some of them with technology skills. And as a result, they couldn't join the global market because that's one of the things that you needed, especially if you're on different time zones, you know, when you're doing business. And here in the United States, in a city like New York, this is a place where business is way ahead of us than education, but it's also a place where it seems to me that it's a natural combination to form a partnership. If I could ask schools and business to work on something, it would be for every business to adopt a school and make sure that it's wired, that it's brought up to snuff, that every teacher has a laptop, and that every kid learns how to use technology. It certainly is one of the places that I have learned, and research shows, that our special needs kids can be productive in ways that they may not be without the technology. And also for our middle school kids, and again, because of the studies that I've done, boys are much more likely to be engaged in school if they're involved with technology. Every school where we put what we call the Connect program, which is one computer for every child, and we put it in single plot of our males, we have seen the progress go. And in schools, we're in summer school sessions where we've used technology as the major teaching tool, we have seen attendance rise dramatically. And also, it's a job skill. So this is where I think we can match. The other things, and I see Charlotte in the back of the room, it goes towards the idea of materials. And I think this is important. I said, how do we work with publishers? And not just for their own interests. I said I was going to be very honest. But for the interest of the kids, how do we sit and talk to people rather than after they make the products? And I know they bring teachers to the table, but the reality is, in business, you would have focus groups. In business, you have lots of focus groups. You would go out and do a lot of surveys. Rather than create something that you find out later either people don't want or, more importantly, don't have the training to do. What we have found, and I think it's particularly true under Leave No Child Behind, certainly I fought all those wars in a multitude of ways and I still have the scars, is that you were moving products that were easy to use because you had the least common denominator vision of teachers. Give teachers something that can follow scripts and that they can't fail. Rather than saying, let's find materials and curriculums that are really high-level thinking. I mean, some of the stuff that you guys have on the internets here are wonderful. And how do you make sure, though, that teachers have time for professional development? I mean, one of the things that Jack Welch would say to us, because we used to meet at Crotonville, which is the General Electric Retreat Center, that he couldn't think of a company that was productive that did not have annual retreats. Retreats where people were paid to actually go off-site to talk, to socialize, and to think about the work that we're doing. Not just to be told, you know, this is what you do tomorrow. And yet think about education. And if you go on retreat, how many people say, oh, they're paying the teachers to go away for a week? They're going to a nice hotel? Oh, they're going to have dinner? Oh, you mean they hired a band to dance at night? This whole notion that educators should be treated any less nicely and more and professionally than business, to me, is a big mistake. I can't tell you how many times I had to explain to the business office that, yes, it's okay to approve a principal who wants to take his staff on retreat as long as there's an agenda and an end goal of what's going to be done during that time. And what's so terrible if you go off-site to get to know your colleagues better so when you come back, you're actually working together for the end goal in the school? And if you took a retreat and then invited the parents to come to the last cocktail party of the retreat so you can actually share with them what you agreed on the retreat, my God, that's even more bang for your buck. When we had our first retreats, we took my staff to Westchester, and I always invited the executive board of the PTA to join us for cocktails, which I paid for because cocktails don't get covered on any purchase order. You know, I didn't need to be in any jail or any place else. And my husband would say, what is this bill? I said, we're treating them to cocktails. But what happened is we went back on Monday energized, excited, celebrated, but with one goal and one purpose. Business understands that. We constantly have to explain it. And that should not be. So how do you get a business person to come in and talk in your communities to explain the importance of the retreats, the importance of professional development? I should not have to go and bend over backwards to explain that to any constituency because it's understood in so many places, but not in education. Oh, they're wasting the time. I mean, I remember that, and again, it becomes, are you a babysitter or are you an educator? And there's a lot of ways to look about that. I think one of the other issues that actually was alluded to this morning, and I was so glad you said it, that I think is really important in terms of the dichotomy between COs and companies and education, is that these CEOs do not often, some of the better ones do, but not all of them, look at the multicultural aspect or the diversity aspect of their employees and the products they serve. The business people decide but what they're going to sell. If they found that maybe in certain communities yellow cars would do better, they might do it, you know, for that community because they know in that community they could sell, but they wouldn't do it across the board. In education, this is not a choice we have. It's a moral imperative. We have to take all the kids to come in many places where things might have been homogeneous. I mean, I certainly know in all of Europe, up until about 10 years ago, you were homogeneous. Only one language, only one set of culture, you know, in terms of the mores that you were doing. And now, you can't do that anymore. So what happens? You adjust in your schools. You figure out how to do it. But you don't tell them, I'm sorry, you're not welcomed here because you don't fit the mode or you're not there. I mean, in New York, we have this whole thing that even if you're, you know, in the legal, you're coming to your school. You get the services. Companies, I don't think, really do that. I mean, there isn't this notion, okay, we are going to make sure that we take in a wide variety of people because our product will be better. Now, I do know that there's some public utilities. I know one in particular, Con Edison in New York, that has now, as a response to their own employees over the last 5 years, put in diversity groups within their employees so that they can bring in guest speakers to understand each other. But that's something that business is learning from education. It's going in the other direction. But I think the fact that we are often faulted for not doing certain things also doesn't take into account the complexity of what education is all about. We are not widgets. We are not products. We are kids. And the kids need sometimes more than a year in a certain grade or in a certain place in order to be successful. So I think that's really important. One of the things that I was asked to emphasize today, and then I really want to open it to questions, comments, is what is the role of Teachers Network? And I think you already kind of have some of the answers. I heard something today that kind of gives me a good feeling inside. Actually, two things, many more, but two I want to mention. Number one is the survey that Teachers Network has done about NCLB. And I think it's very important for teachers to be able to speak with one voice nationally and internationally and say, this is what we believe in, this is what we feel, and be able to become politically active. I did ask for the handout on the teacher advocacy piece. I think teachers for too long, mainly because many of us were women and people were afraid of their jobs. If you're in a small community, and really, you know, our job is in the classroom. How many times have you heard that? Oh, you know, I just want to work with my children. The reality is, if that's the mindset that you have, someday that situation is no longer going to exist. It really has to be, what is happening in the bigger world that's having real impact in my classroom that I need to either individually or collectively or anonymously get involved in? Having a script, and that's what I saw that he developed, and if you didn't take his stuff, you really, I'm sorry, your first name?
Mark.
Mark's stuff. They actually have a script that teachers use to call local politicians to advocate for things in their community. This is not a leisure time activity. If anything, teachers need to be the first people to show what citizenship is at its best. And advocacy is local. I mean, certainly in New York and in major urban cities, most of the changes are happening at the local level. I mean, it's nice to say the state is here and the federal government is there, but the local level has a lot to do. And as we move into an election time, having teachers advocate for what they believe in through organizations, to me, is not an option. In fact, I don't think people have a choice. They need to do it, and how you do it. I mean, one of the things I would say as a principal, and I was fearless in almost all my jobs, but I would say, look, one of the reasons I believe my parents' association had to hear everything I was doing and I made sure they were part of my cabinet is when I couldn't speak for myself, or the parents spoke for us. Because who else is the major client in your building are the parents. And they know what's best for their kids, so getting them also to be part of your advocacy group means that you need to be transparent with them. And being able to say, you know, I'm a parent of a child in a public school, sometimes they don't think the parents in public school go out to vote. Or in many urban cities, I mean, I'm thinking of Chicago, one of the reasons that things happened in some ways they happened is because there was a vacuum that someone had to fill. So how do you get teachers involved in advocacy, not from a union perspective, although, you know, that obviously has its place, but from this is what I need to be more the better teacher, because if I'm the better teacher, your kids will be more successful. And again, advocating for all kids. I still can't say enough that very often people wish special ed kids to disappear from the face of the earth. And not only is it not going to happen, picture yourself as a parent of a child who has all these special needs, and all of a sudden 50% of the schools in the system will not take your kid. I mean, that is just not, that's not why we became educators. So I think that's really important. I think also one of the things that I remember, and I don't know how long ago this was, Ellen, there was a motto in Teachers Network, I think when it was Impact, is take an idea and be creative, right? I don't
take
know
an idea and go creative.
Go creative. And I think teaching is still one of those professions that allows you to be creative. And although I read a lot of your survey, I don't buy the idea that teachers still can't be creative. I do buy the idea that teachers need to explain more thoroughly why they're being so creative. But if a teacher is doing something uniquely different in their classroom and a supervisor comes along and says, you know, it's 10:20 and you're not on, you know, skill drill 45, then you need to be able to say, well, you know, skill drill 45 wants the kids to be able to do a narrative piece, and I'm using this creative way to get to the narrative piece. So I think for too long, educators have also gotten away with the closed door syndrome of nobody questioning what you were doing. I think you should be questioned, but you should be able then with logic and understanding. And I think making sure that that good ideas go on the website. Because to me, it's the way that other people will go creative, and maybe creating as part of the website, you know, how to, you know, getting, and I know you're aligned to the state standards, and, you know, state standards are almost the same in every single state, but how do you ensure that you're promoting literacy? And again, this is my personal favorite. I don't think that you can promote any kind of literacy without class libraries. I just don't. I think independent reading. I mean, we need to read in order the way people read in the real world. In New York, we made sure that we had more, that we looked at books, and we had a focus group of boys to read books for us and say one of the reasons boys weren't reading is that they said most of the books in class libraries didn't appeal to them. So we found subjects, but also we found that males tend to read more nonfiction than fiction. So we want, and most books that were being ordered by female teachers. So we also asked for more magazines to go into classrooms so that we could meet the needs of the kids. But taking these ideas and then aligning them to the state standards, but say you can go creative within these parameters. And I think the more you put on the website where people can take those ideas from, the better it will be. I think also using the technology. The idea that more and more of the professional development is going to be done through telecommunications and technology is definitely the way it's going to be. And also teacher-to-teacher sharing is very, very important. So I think that's where I really see Teachers Network not only playing an important part, but continuing to doing what they do best. I think that ultimately business and education have to work together. I think the major problem that I see is that business is not the ultimate model, or all businesses, for all educational strategies. And until there's an understanding that there has to be mutual respect, and I will tell you that one of the things that was started, I believe in California, San Francisco, I think Ray Cortina started, was called Principal for the Day. And any of you involved, did you do Principal for the Day? Okay. And I thought Principal for the Day was a great idea. I thought Principal for the Day brought in business people into the schools. The notion was that we were supposed to host them, and we were supposed to show them how hard our job was, and then they were going to help us by materials, support, but all at the time also public relations. It was at a time when education wasn't getting such good press, and these people were all going to go back to their businesses. My God, you know, how hard the job is. And I, naively enough, as a principal, thought it was a two-way street, that they were going to listen to me, and that then they were going to see what a great job I was really doing, you know, and say, oh, my God, you know, look, she has a school of 900 kids, and, you know, they're doing very well. And I found, ultimately, that the first 3 years that I did it, all I had is to listen to them. And eventually I said, I don't want to do this anymore, and Lisa would call me, you know, and say, but Carmen, your school has to be. We have a whole list of people who want to go there. And I said, you know what, until people come into my building and respect the work I do and understand the difference between my job and their job, I don't want any more principals for the day. And if you're going to send me a principal for the day, send me a politician who I can really get their ear and really advocate for what I need in this building. Or give me someone who wants to go into teaching, who can spend a day with me and understand what it's like to be a principal in a building. And, I mean, I know we've made changes, and, you know, I've worked with Principal for the Day since then to make sure that some of the things they've done have been modified. But I feel that if businesses are constantly going to be the leaders of what we do, we have to take a more proactive role and show that we can be leaders in our own right. That there are things that we do well, there are things we're willing to change, and that there are things we need to be respected for. And being part of an affiliate, which I think is one of the few organizations I know that takes people not only nationally but internationally and says, look, we have a common goal. Our goal is to raise the level of teaching, to make teachers decision makers, to reward people who have good ideas, but more importantly, to come together so we can ensure, no matter where you go in the world, that there are some things that we can all talk about. If you meet a teacher, even if you don't understand their language, I know when we had the people from Japan, I thought they were going to come in with a very different, the minister who came in said to me, we have the same problems you have. Actually, they had a bigger gap between their males and females. And from socioeconomics, their gaps were tremendous in terms of, because of the way they accept kids into their schools. So I think teaching is a subversive activity. I think it's important that people, you know, work together. And I think Teachers Network is actually on the right target, you know, in the right way of going, But I think the one bit of advice that I would give is that you need to advocate more in areas outside of education. I think we really need to bring business people to the table and say, okay, enough. Listen to us. We know you need a workforce, but this is what we need as well. And we need you to respect us for what we do. We may not make the big bucks that you guys make, but at the very least, have us at the table when decisions are made. Because more and more in this country, the decisions are being made by people that are not educators. And ultimately, the people who are going to pay the price, I think, are the teachers in the classrooms. And I'm sorry to say, I don't want my grandchildren to have to pay the price as well. So do I believe in COs? Yes. I'd like to think the notion master teacher is a better terminology. But I think that if I had to take over a business company right now at this stage of my life, I could do it relatively easy. I really think I know the practices of leadership. I would like, however, one of those COs to come over and take over a school for a week. I'm not saying even a year, just a week. And I guarantee you they would have a much tougher time. So let's learn from each other and let's work together, but let's also respect the differences that exist between business and education.